From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
A little bug that could cause a lot of trouble. Hello again, I'm Warren Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issue Southern Californians care about. 93 square miles of the San Gabriel Valley are now under a citrus quarantine because of a bug that could cost California $2 billion. It carries a disease called citrus greening, and it's been found on a backyard lemon tree in Hacienda Heights. That could lead to a nightmare for citrus growers that's already happened in Florida. We'll hear what's at stake and what you should look for in your backyard. Also tonight, from Bhutan to the UN to the USA, should gross national product be replaced as a goal by gross national happiness? First, here's the news. Warren Alney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The United Nations now has happiness on the global agenda. That's a major achievement for Bhutan, a Himalayan country of less than a million people. Which are the happiest country, and who decides? What are the obstacles to reaching the UN's new goal? We'll talk about that later on. First, from Baldwin Park and West Covina, south to La Habra, from El Monte, east to Walnut, citrus is under quarantine. If you have an orchard or just a backyard orange, lemon, or grapefruit tree, you're not allowed to take a fruit off the property. What's at stake is nothing less than California's $2 billion citrus industry. David Karp is a writer and photographer of fruit who writes the LA Times Market Watch column and does research on citrus at UC Riverside. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
This is called citrus greening, if you don't use the original word. What is it? What does it do?
It's a bacterial disease that kills citrus. It's the most devastating of all citrus diseases. It takes its time to kill them, maybe anywhere from 1 to 5 years, but it definitely is going to kill them at some point. The symptoms are not always evident immediately, so you might not think that your tree is infected, but it could be. And in Florida, it's already destroyed several hundred thousand of their formerly 900,000 acres. About a third of those are gone, largely due to greening. And it's devastated every country with a suitable habitat in which greening has occurred. The disease originated in South Asia probably a century or more ago and was first detected in southern China a little less than a century ago, and it's made its way through most of the major citrus-growing areas of the world.
You say it takes 1 to 5 years to kill the tree. Can you rescue the tree in the meantime if you find it?
Generally not. Once it gets the disease, the scientific consensus is that it's going to die. You can put it off with nutrition, which is what some growers in Florida are trying to do. There are some commercial growers who say, look, if I pull out all these trees, I'm going to be out of business. So let's give them the best possible care and try to nurse them along, producing at least a modest crop until a solution can be found.
What carries it?
The Asian citrus psyllid, which is a small gnat-like insect, is the vector of Huanlongbing. And the insect itself is a problem for citrus, but not a very serious problem. It's only in conjunction with this disease because what it does is it feeds on the leaves of the tree, which will be infected with this bacterium, and then it goes into its gut, and then it conveys it when it feeds on another tree. And it can fly a fair distance, a quarter, half a mile, nobody really knows, 2 miles. It can be blown by the wind like they had in Florida with a hurricane. So this Asian citrus psyllid, which was found 3 years ago, has been present in California. The disease was not present until it was announced on March 30th that a find had been both an HLB positive Asian citrus psyllid was found and a tree that tested positive for the disease in Hacienda Heights, about 20 miles east of Los Angeles.
And HLB is Huanlongbing. That's the original name of the disease.
That's the Chinese name. It means, by various accounts, yellow shoot disease or yellow dragon disease.
So could anybody with an orange tree or lemon tree or grapefruit tree in the Los Angeles area have this?
Absolutely. And the symptoms are yellow blotchy mottling. And if you look at the website www.californiacitrusthreat.org, you can see photographs of what these symptoms look like.
And where is the yellow blotting mottling? Is it on the tree or the bark, or is it on the leaves?
It's on the leaves.
On the leaves, okay. And what's that website again?
www.californiacitrusthreat.org, or you can, if you think that you observe symptoms on your own or local citrus trees, homeowners, please call the California Department of Food and Agriculture's pest hotline, which is 800-491-1899. That's 800-491-1899. The much of Southern California already has the Asian citrus psyllid. Huanlongbing disease has only been identified so far in the Hacienda Heights area and just on one tree and one psyllid, as far as I'm aware. But it's very likely that it's in other backyards around California. And the question is, where did that come from? Would you like to know?
Yes.
Okay. There are several ways that it could have come here. One, most likely, we think it was brought in by somebody who thought that they wanted a variety from Southern Asia that they didn't have here. This disease was observed on a pomelo, which is the giant ancestor of the grapefruit. And they don't taste quite the same here as they do there for various reasons. Different varieties, different growing areas. Anyway, somebody probably thought, I want the same kind of fruit I grew up with. So they smuggled in budwood, or somebody, a friend of theirs, smuggled in that budwood. That's material for grafting, the actual variety that you graft onto a rootstock. Because this disease is graft transmissible, it's so easy to spread the disease, and you would never know. You could have seen the tree itself in China, and it might not have developed symptoms yet. They often don't for a while.
A lot of people do this, bring in the budwood and graft trees onto each other?
There's a certain amount of it. There's anecdotal evidence. There's people I've spoken to, in addition to being a scientist and a journalist, I'm also a member of California Rare Fruit Growers. And I've heard people whisper, so-and-so got such and such a thing. There's a whole, you know, like that book out of Florida, the Orchid Thief. There's a whole culture of that. Growing rare fruit, for some people, it's like a drug. They just can't wait to get the newest, a different thing that somebody else, that nobody else has, or perhaps something that they grew up with, a variety they grew up with as a child, has evoked strong emotions. There are other pathways, though, however. The disease is present in Mexico, and large quantities of Mexican limes are shipped up here. If they're not properly cleaned, I mean, according to existing regulations, USDA regulations, they have to be cleaned of vegetative material on which the insect feeds. But did somebody make a mistake every once in a while and miss a couple of leaves? Who knows? That's another potential pathway.
David Karp again with the LA Times and UC Riverside. Link Evans is a fourth-generation general manager of Levin's Ranches. He has 1,100 acres in Ventura and Monterey counties. Link Levin's, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. Good to be here.
How worried are you about Huanlongbing?
We are, the industry is quasi-terrified of the thing, and we are trying to learn from the experience that Florida has had with their lack of attacking the psyllid, and David has done a very good job of laying out the description of what we're up against.
So what are you doing about it?
We are. We have traps that both the CDFA and the Citrus Research Board and are putting throughout California. The CDFA people are taking care of.
What's the CDFA?
I am sorry about that. California Department of Food and Agriculture.
Okay.
And so we have traps. We have thousands of traps all over California, trying to identify where those psyllids are and whether or not they have the presence of Huanlongbing (HLB).
So the psyllid then is the bug. So what if you trap one? How does that help you?
Well, as David indicated, they are throughout Southern California, but we don't know whether they've got the disease or not. So we are aggressively have the quarantine areas. We currently don't have the psyllids in Ventura County and up in the San Joaquin Valley, where the bulk of the citrus is grown. And so we are doing everything we can to make sure that the psyllid population doesn't get established in either backyards or in our commercial citrus.
Okay, the psyllid is the bug, and it can either carry the disease, or if it alights on a tree that has it, it can pick it up and then carry it someplace else. But again, once you trap one, obviously you can't trap all the psyllids. They're tiny little bugs. What do you do then? Do you spray?
We spray, and this is why we're enacting. In Ventura County, we have 800,000 people that live here, and we have 100,000 irrigated acres, 20 of which are citrus. So we are doing everything we can to keep the population of the psyllid down, because that was the mistake Florida made.
Tell us about the citrus industry and how it's changed in the four generations that your family's been involved in it.
Oh my goodness, my goodness. Well, I'm fortunate enough. I've got 28 bosses, so I farm for all my cousins and nieces and nephews, and we have evolved so that
you do the work. You do the work, and they get the money. Is that?
Well, they keep an eye on me too.
Okay, all right.
That's the concept. But Ventura County has steadfastly stayed in the citrus industry, and the people that are here feel that agriculture is something they want to stay, and we're going to try and make sure that it does stay here as long as it can be profitable.
Tell us a bit about what happened in Florida and whether the same thing might happen here.
Well, as David indicated, the hurricanes really caused the problem. They knew they had the psyllid, and they didn't worry about it because it wasn't a problem. Those three hurricanes came through about 8 years ago, and they just acted like a washing machine, and they just turned it and put the psyllid everywhere, and all of a sudden it was infected with HLB. Again, somebody from some other country smuggled something in, and it was rampant throughout. So now they're fighting a losing battle. And we've spent millions of dollars trying to identify where this psyllid is and to contain it and keep it out of the commercial citrus areas. Likely, it's going to show up in somebody's backyard, and we are trying to do a full court press education process to make sure that people understand that if they get the disease, their citrus tree is going to die. So we are treating the trees and backyards as well as any potential in the commercial orchards.
How do you treat them? What do you do?
We have about seven different chemicals that we have available ready to go, and in the backyard they use a material called imidacloprid, and that is the same material that we put on our cats and dogs to kill the fleas, and it's systemic, and it goes into the tree and goes down into the ground and kills the psyllids.
So you can then save the tree? I indicated from David Karp that you probably can't, or I've got that impression.
Well, there are two folds of it. Part of it is the psyllid, which is the insect that David talked about, and we can kill the psyllid, but we want to make sure that the psyllid doesn't have the disease. So the idea is to remove the number of psyllids so they can't transmit the disease.
Well, if you call the pest hotline and they come out to your yard and find that indeed your tree is infested, are they going to take the tree out?
They won't take the tree out unless it shows up positive for the HLB, which is the one that they discovered in Hacienda Heights, and that's the concern. The homeowners can do themselves a big favor by pulling up the website and looking and seeing what the psyllids look like, and then do their own inspection, and that's probably their best bet, because they can determine, they can just keep an eye on your trees to make sure it doesn't have it on it.
Okay, and once again, you look at the leaves for that yellow blotching, I take it.
No, because the yellow blotching is from the disease. The psyllids look like little pieces of brown.
Oh, first you look for the psyllids. I see. Okay, go ahead.
Right. Little pieces of brown rice, and they only like the tips. So the place you look is right at the tip, at the apical meristem tips, where the new little leaves are coming out. That's likely where they're going to show up.
Let me go back to David Karp, again with the LA Times and UC Riverside. Big growers can spray. Are backyarders going to be able to do that, though?
You know, I think that yes, they can. You can speak to nurseries from which you buy trees. There are home imidacloprid treatments that are available.
So you can do something. You can save your tree. Sounds to me, though, as if it's a good idea to get a new one.
If a tree is infected, you have to pull the old one out. Do yourself and your neighbors a favor by pulling out the infected tree. There's only been one infected tree found so far. If there are Asian citrus psyllids present on your tree, you could apply imidacloprid, which is a drench that will kill the psyllids that feed on that tree, and you'll be helping yourself and your neighbors, but in a slightly different way.
And Link Levins, how much have you spent already trying to keep your crops healthy from this citrus greening or wong wong bing?
Well, the industry has assessed itself 9 cents a field box for all of it to assist the California Department of Food and Agriculture in treating those areas in L.A. So to this point, we've spent about $100 an acre so far. But as far as treatment, we haven't had to treat anything outside of our regular integrated pest controls.
That kind of money, though, cheap at the price if you're talking about saving an entire crop or an orchard or 1,100 acres.
The Florida people would take $100 an acre in a heartbeat. They're at $800 an acre now and in a losing battle.
Okay, we'll have that website that we heard and also the pest hotline up on our website, kcrw.com/whichwayLA. Link Levins and David Karp, many thanks for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Warren.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, gross national happiness on Which Way LA. We're not only back with Which Way LA. 40 years ago, the king of Bhutan suggested that happiness should replace economic output as a measure of human advancement. Last week, his grandson, the current king, led a UN conference on happiness and well-being, defining a new economic paradigm. Lisa Napoli is a public radio host here at KCRW in Santa Monica. She's also author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa Napoli, good to have you on our program.
Hey, thanks, Warren.
Is Bhutan the happiest kingdom on earth?
It sounds like a good marketing slogan.
It certainly does.
Yeah, no, it isn't, and nor does the king, nor did the king when he suggested GNH years ago intend for it to become that way. It's just taken on a life of its own because we want to believe that there's a place that's the happiest one on earth.
Well, tell us how this idea evolved and what's happened in the past 40 years, particularly last week at the UN.
Sure. Well, basically, the king 40 years ago was answering a reporter from the West who was asking how he was going to drive Bhutan into the 20th century. Basically, Bhutan didn't have roads or currency or schools, electricity. None of those developments came to Bhutan until about 40 years ago. And most importantly, it didn't have mass media or any sort of outsiders. No one was allowed in, and very few people came out to go to school. So the king thought that the best way for his country to get into the 20th century, even though it was midway through, was to basically do it carefully, deliberately, and not do it rampant, development, and to protect the environment, to protect the family, to protect the culture, and to trust the government. Those are the pillars that he set forth, but he wasn't prescribing any way to be happy. He was just basically saying he didn't want to grow too fast and sort of plummet underneath the weight of development, since they hadn't had any of it in the modern sense. What's happened is, over the last 10 years, as our economy has tanked, people have wanted to find a way to be happy and to measure things differently, because a wide number of people believe that GDP is flawed as an economic metric to check out how things are going in a particular place. And so they've leaned on the government of Bhutan to develop a scale where Bhutan didn't have one. Bhutan just basically was living by its Buddhist principles to tread the middle path and develop slowly. And now you have a bunch of people, world-famous economists, clamoring for Bhutan's secret, even though Bhutan doesn't really have a secret. And that's what happened at the UN last week. Everybody got together at the helm of the prime minister, at the behest of the prime minister of Bhutan, the first elected prime minister of Bhutan, and basically they convened all sorts of panels to discuss economists' look at ways of measuring what's happening in a particular place, a city or a country, without relying completely on money. That's a pretty radical thought.
It is indeed. Lisa Napoli of KCRW, author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. John Helliwell is professor emeritus in the economics department at the University of British Columbia. He's co-director of the Social Interactions, Identity, and Well-Being program at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research and co-author of the World Happiness Report, which he presented at the United Nations conference last Monday. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
What did you report?
Well, what we set ourselves the objective of doing is drawing together all the data that are available from a number of people who've surveyed many countries, measures of happiness as defined by people themselves, both what they called affect measures, happy yesterday and sad and so on, and more importantly and more revealingly, life evaluations, either asked to think of your life as a ladder, a scale of 0 to 10, are you at the top, the bottom, or the middle, any number you want. And also people in different surveys are asked about how satisfied they are with their life as a whole, and still other surveys how happy they are with their lives as a whole. They give slightly different answers, but it turns out those different answers are explained by the same factors. The numbers that have got all the attention since the report was released are based on the ladder question because it has been asked by the Gallup World Poll now for half a dozen years in more than 150 countries. So then if we really want a world report, we want to get all the countries we can. And so that's the measure that we've been reporting and analyzing. The report also goes through what is now close to 30 years of research on what are the determinants of happiness and what hints do they provide for better ways for governments to do things.
With countries as different as they are, take, for example, the United States and Bhutan, how do you come up with a single measure of happiness or any way to compare what would seem to me to be apples and oranges?
Well, maybe, but it's surprising that, for example, if we take a single model based on something like five factors, which ranked in terms of the importance they take in explaining these international differences, the greatest is family and friends. Do you have someone to count on in times of trouble? The second would be the state of your physical health. The third would be your material resources as measured by your income. The fourth would be your sense of freedom to develop your life as you choose. And the fifth would be the sense of trust in your environment as evidenced by lack of corruption in business and government. Together, those five factors explain more than 85% of the differences between the top four countries, which are in Northern Europe, and the bottom four, which are in South Saharan Africa. So it does look like people, in fact, all over the world bear those same factors as being important and attach somewhat similar weights to them. There are some differences as you move around the world by region and culture. But these fundamental factors come through with quite a lot of power.
You mentioned the word environment in the context of the corruption of industry and government. What about the environment in the context of the environment? Is that also a factor in happiness?
It almost surely is, but it's currently not. I mean, there are a number of studies about people, in fact, doing better when they can see green. They learn faster. They get out of hospital faster. They live better and longer lives. This is sort of the local environment. Part of what was under study at the meeting in the UN, because it was intended in part to flow into the run-up to Rio Plus 20, was what are the takeaways at this point of combining the happiness focus with the environment. And the take I took on it on the basis of the research, and this is still very early days, is that time and again, speakers at the conference presented research showing that human beings are essentially altruistic. They really, more than they think they are, they get pleasure of doing things out of doing things with others and for others. And so routinely, that kind of altruistic behavior has been brought into play more readily with people you identify with. So it starts out being family and friends and tribe and town and country. To solve the global warming kinds of issues, it'll be necessary to fashion broader and more encompassing identities that include not just people far away in today's generation, but people in subsequent generations. And once that's done, and if it's done, and if it's done well, then you'll probably find huge changes in behavior as people do the right thing, as the research also suggests they like to do. They need norms, they want norms, and when they have the norms, they're pretty good at following them.
And to be happy, you're saying, you have to have a sense of community with people who are far away, both in time and distance.
Well, to deal with global objectives, you do. Most of life is lived pretty locally and pretty close to home. And under those circumstances, of course, most of your altruism is shown to those people, and most of that benefits are similarly local. But to some extent, in the kind of world we live in now, we have to develop and harness these broader identities, which will be a big trick.
John Halliwell, once again, the co-author of the World Happiness Report for the United Nations. Lisa Napoli, back to you. You spent a year in Bhutan. How does this definition of happiness, or these definitions, these characteristics of definitions that we've heard laid out, appeal to the people in Bhutan?
Well, I think it does. The challenge comes when you start introducing television, which Bhutan only did 11 years ago. It sort of dissolves all the fabric of society when people look inward at their TVs and not outward at their neighbors. But it's definitely clear even today. When I first went to Bhutan, it was 2007. And even in 2007 through till now, you see that people are much more community-minded and family-minded in Bhutan, and the preservation of the environment is indeed a paramount concern of the government. So, but that is changing. It's changing. Modernization, technology are changing everything in the way people interact with each other, which of course begins to dissolve these things that we're talking about. The altruistic behaviors become a little bit harder to enforce and recommend when people are worried about getting a bigger car, which unfortunately is starting to happen in Bhutan, now that there are cars to want to have.
So people in Bhutan, then, where once there were no outsiders, have now seen on television what they don't have, and it turns out that perhaps in order to be happy, they want it. Are we back to economics again?
Yeah, you know, another thing that Bhutan has done to keep the growth deliberate and measured is to, once they had allowed in tourists, charge a very high tourist tariff to keep out all but the people who really wanted to go, who had $250 a day to pay to be there. And, of course, that further warps the Bhutan's perception of the outside world, because all they see are people who have lots of money, and, of course, they can do the math. They see what $250 a day in a place where the average income, if there is an income, because most people still subsistence farm, is a couple of bucks a day. It's a warping influence. And, of course, people are human. They want a warm, clean bed. That's what shows up in all the happiness research, that as long as you have your minimum needs taken care of, the everything beyond that is superfluous. But the problem is that you want electricity. That's a basic need. And once you get it, it just keeps you wanting more and more. So, yes, it does all go back to economics.
So focusing on gross national happiness for the past 40 years has not necessarily made the people in Bhutan any happier.
Well, and it's important to know that most of the people in Bhutan have not been focusing on gross national happiness for the last 40 years. The king made that remark. It was sort of an offhanded remark that was pulled from their Buddhist values. And now that we're forcing the GNH thing, a lot of people, the most educated people in Bhutan, are angry about the idea of GNH. They don't want to hear us saying that they're happy. They don't want to hear us forcing on them this notion that they are a happier people. There's irony in the subtitle of my book, and a lot of people don't see that because, of course, they want to believe it, that it's so happy. But no, it's things are changing rapidly in Bhutan, and it does have to do with our introduction there and our sort of giddiness, if you will, about GNH. It's complicated.
Okay, that subtitle, What I Learned on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. John Helliwell, back to you, the co-author of the World Happiness Report. Is there something counterproductive about all this?
I haven't seen anything counterproductive about it. People react in different ways. Some of the initial stuff is, how does our country rank? But once people get over that, they start then asking, well, what do you suppose is it that makes the rankings on happiness different from the rankings on income? And then sometimes the penny drops, and they said, yes, I guess that's right. Now that I really think about it, the longer commute may not be worth it, and the whole lot of things they think about differently. Framing is really important. If all you see is the ads that says you need a bigger and better car, then you'll start to think that's what you need. But if you get more and more reminders that the greenest product on earth is a smile, and it makes you feel better and make other people feel better, then you start to have people thinking about life in a different way. We actually have measures of happiness in Bhutan. They have quite a big survey they've been running for a while. They don't make a lot of happiness measures in their own accounting. They use a bunch of social indicators to get at it. But they do have this measure of happiness, and it's the same question that's asked in the European Social Survey. So we actually can make a pretty fair fist, although Bhutan is not in the Gallup World Poll that we got the world rankings from. It is in, they do ask a question that's rather like one that's asked elsewhere, and they're happier than most countries at their level of income. But of the 29 countries in the European Social Survey, Bhutan would be sort of 26 or so out of the 29. They're slightly happier than their neighbors around them. They're about as happy as India and significantly happier than China, Nepal, and Bangladesh. So it isn't as though that either by government decree or people making a decision, people will become giddily happier. In Bhutan, when they're now applying all of this, it isn't really driven by the West at all. It's their own thinking about how they might get on with it. They start evaluating their planning with a little more attention to non-economic things.
John Helliwell, again, at the University of British Columbia and co-author of the World Happiness Report presented to the UN last Monday. John DeGraff is co-founder of the Happiness Initiative based in Seattle. He's also author of What's the Economy For Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. Welcome to you.
Great to be there.
How is it? Why is it time to stop chasing growth and start pursuing happiness? Why is gross national happiness a better measure than gross national product?
Well, for one thing, limitless growth on a finite planet is simply not sustainable, and I think that's very clear. One of the points made at the UN meeting was that if every country were to suddenly consume at the levels that Americans consume today, we need four or five planets to make that possible. So we simply can't grow on like this, and we have to find some other way of promoting well-being and quality of life that just doesn't depend on more and more and more stuff. And I think the happiness movement is a great way to do that, a great way to get us to think about something different. And I'm honored to be on with Lisa and with John Helliwell, who's done such great research on this.
Well, what are you doing here in the United States, and in what way could the United States adjust itself to this kind of a measure?
Well, one thing we do with the Happiness Initiative is we've taken a survey that was originally developed for Bhutan. It's about 4 hours long, the subjective survey in Bhutan. One fainted while taking it, for example. And with help originally from folks from Canada who shortened it to 30 minutes and used it in Victoria, B.C., we further shortened it to about 12 to 15 minutes, and we had assistance in doing that from San Francisco State University's psychology department. And you can take that survey online at happycounts, happycounts.org. When you take the survey, it measures your well-being in 10 areas of life, and that's based on the 9 domains that the Bhutanese use, things like confidence in government and time balance and health and mental health and so forth, and also financial security. We add a 10th domain, work experience, from Gallup, because we know that in the United States, how you feel about your life at work also has an enormous impact on your well-being. When you take the survey, you get a score, and that compares you with a national random survey of Americans that was done using the survey. So if you're above 50 in any one of these domains, then you feel like you can feel like you're doing a little better than the average American, or maybe a lot better. If you're below 50, you're not doing as well as the average American. These questions or these scores don't tell you this means you're unhappy or you're very happy, but they tell you about the balance in your life. They tell you about whether there's things you need to look at in your life. If you get a time balance score of 25, for example, it doesn't mean you're unhappy, but it means that it's a warning sign. You should look at it. If it comes from the fact that you just had a baby or you're working on your PhD dissertation, it may not be something to worry about. But if it comes from a chronic, long-term situation that's negative, then it will affect many of these other domains. It will affect your health. It will affect your social connection that John Helliwell pointed out is so important, your community connections. And so you have to think about that. That's what the survey allows people to do, is to assess their lives based on well-being and happiness rather than simply on their economic status.
Does this test, or survey, I should say, require people to use other measures than economics? Or you said that was included, but it's only one out of, what, 10?
One out of 10, yes. So it allows people to think about all of those aspects which John Helliwell pointed out are really important for well-being. It adds a few, but I agree with John in terms of the ones that are most important. But there are other things like access to education and arts and culture and things that we also measure and that do matter. And I think it's a great way, if people go to Happy Counts and take the survey, they'll get a sense of how they're doing. We are using that with communities around the country, places like Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and Nevada City, California, Seattle, Washington, so that communities can assess their overall well-being, and they can see where they're thriving, where they're hurting, and they can begin to talk about the kinds of policies that might make it possible to improve those scores. We're also working with about 100 colleges and universities where classes are doing the surveys and talking about them, or larger departments are doing the surveys and so forth, thinking about life assessment for students based on a well-being survey like this. So there are many applications. It's very exciting work, and we're happy to be a part of it. And the idea, though, really came from Bhutan, and we acknowledge that.
You talked about a finite planet at the outset and how unlimited growth for everybody is simply not sustainable. Does the survey, when people end up as less happy than they want to be, under 50, let's say, does it cause them to want to change their behavior?
Well, we hope so. We don't know for sure, but we are getting anecdotal evidence from people that they have changed some behaviors based on it. We get stories from people who say, well, I found out that my community participation score was low, and I thought, wow, I need to do something about this. So I got involved in this group or that group. So far, that evidence is anecdotal. We're very new. All of this is a new process. It's really only been happening for a little over a year. So, but we're hoping that this is going to affect behavior. That's certainly the intention.
What about public policy? Has any public policy been instituted as a result of the surveys or for any other reason having to do with your project?
Not yet, but we expect that to happen in the near future. One of the issues we've had is that so far our surveys have all been opt-in, so people in these communities come in and they can just take the survey on their own and they get a score. Now, communities are also looking for surveys that are random so that they really get a clear sampling of their community. And for instance, in Seattle, they're talking about doing that, so when they put the two things together, they can make some meaningful policies. Eau Claire, Wisconsin is conducting both an opt-in survey. They've had more than 2,000 people take that survey. It's a town of 60,000. And they're also conducting a random survey through the University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire. They intend to take those results into a series of town meetings in the next month or so, and from those town meetings recommend policies to the city government and go from there. So,
What's an example of a policy that might come out of that process?
At the local level, I'm not certain, but I can say that, for instance, businesses can also use this kind of thing. There was a business in Brazil, for example, a large company that used a survey similar to the one that we use. I used the longer one also that you used in Victoria, B.C. They found that their employees were very, very low on time balance. That's often a low score, particularly in the United States.
And time balance means, elaborate a bit on that.
Work-life balance, you know, your sense of life being in a rush, in a hurry, not having the time to do the things that are important to you. Bhutan has pointed out that this is an important thing. It's part of their survey work, that we simply are rushing too much and we're trying so hard to get the stuff and make the stuff that we don't have time for life.
John Helliwell, let me go back to you, a co-author of the World Happiness Report, Professor Emeritus at the University of British Columbia. What do you see as potential policies coming out of gross national happiness assessments?
It sort of happens at the second stage. You first of all find out that there are significant differences across countries and across communities. Then you look and find out why. And then you ask what can be done in your community or in your own life to make a difference. And John's groups are doing just that.
Are there any examples of places where policies have, in fact, been changed or formulated and enacted on as a result of a happiness survey?
Well, there's sometimes the policies are changed as though they were based on subjective well-being research. I wrote a paper on the Singapore prison system reforms, which are just the kind of things you'd do if you did this research seriously. So it engaged the prisoners with the guards, both with the communities, and recidivism dropped by a third, and everybody is happier inside and outside the system. We've done experiments in elder care facilities where people are simply given a chance to do more things for themselves and with each other, and they turn out to be happier and healthier as a consequence. So both in terms of specific experiments, which are the kind of grist that policymakers really want to see if they're going to apply things more broadly, it turns out that things are different in the provision of all kinds of public services. In the UK, where they're doing a lot of attempt to collect data more broadly and also apply it to the making of public policies, one of the first things they've done is redo their cost-benefit analysis, how you evaluate public projects. And it's now being done in terms of well-being and not just in terms of dollar costs and benefits. Or another way of thinking about it is you can convert some of these previously unmeasured things like changes in community trust and so on into monetary terms because you know how much both income and trust affect well-being. And so it really does make a difference. We've done some experimental work in Canada, and the cost-benefit analysis based on well-being does give you very different answers.
John Halliwell, once again at University of British Columbia and co-author of the World Happiness Report. Sonia Lubomirsky is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and author of The How of Happiness, a scientific approach to getting the life you want. Good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
Now, this sounds much more, according to the subtitle of your book, much more of an individual approach. Selfish, if you will, in that sense, I don't mean to put a value on that, than what we've heard before.
Well, that's right. I approach happiness from a psychological perspective, from an individual perspective. So the question that I address in my research is, can people become happier as individuals? And if yes, how can they become happier? How can they do that successfully?
What did you conclude?
Well, my conclusion is absolutely yes. I mean, we do know that there's a large genetic component in happiness and individual differences in happiness, so some people are just naturally happier than others. We also know, as we heard about today, that there are lots of sort of environmental, contextual kind of variables that influence happiness, so not as much as we think. So things like wealth and health and trust do influence our happiness. But then there's a part of our happiness that's completely under our control, sort of through our behaviors, through the ways that we act, through the ways that we think, we can improve our happiness. And so what we do in our lab is we do what are called happiness interventions, which are basically experiments that prompt people to practice different kinds of strategies to try to be more grateful, to be kind to others. We already heard about sort of community service, to be more optimistic, to improve their relationships, and then we follow them across time to see if those strategies do, in fact, make people happier, and I'm happy to report that they do.
How large a sample do you have? Can you cite?
Well, you know, each individual experiment is not that huge, just like with any kind of intervention or clinical trial. So we might have, 60 people in a study. Sometimes we have up to 200 people. And we always have several conditions. We have a control group. We have different kinds of control groups. So just, you know, we have, I think, enough people. We have enough power to conclude that happiness interventions work.
What do you do with people who are, through no fault of their own, for example, unemployed and seem to have no way of getting jobs? We hear more and more horror stories of people who have been unemployed for long periods of time and unable to get work. Are you able to intervene with people like that, or are they simply beyond your scope?
Right. You know, it's a great question. In fact, we already talked about earlier how people tend to adapt to almost anything in life. So we buy a bigger house and we just want another house. The same thing goes for negative events except for unemployment. Unemployment is something that people just do not adapt to. When you follow people across time, you know, years after losing a job, even when you get a new job, people are still less happy than they were before that sort of that episode. Now, I don't personally work with people who are unemployed, but the research suggests that even with people who are unemployed or people who have experienced traumatic experience or people who are depressed, that there are strategies that they can use to become happier, so it is not hopeless, but they have to put a lot more effort into it, a lot more effort into sort of, you know, working on their relationships or or trying to be more grateful, trying to be more positive, or trying to change their life in some way. They have to put more effort into it, but they can become happier.
Would you encourage people to take 12 or 15 minutes and go to happycounts.org and take the survey?
Sure, of course. I mean, that's going to tell them sort of roughly where they lie in happiness on the continuum, but also, as we heard earlier, it's going to tell them sort of what areas of their life need improvement. Now, it may not be a surprise to them. I think usually it's not. But sometimes it's just sort of nice to have that validated to sort of tell yourself, I really need to work more on my marriage, or I need to work more on, my work.
What about the notion that most people have that a level, at some level, of material well-being is absolutely essential to happiness? I take it that is a part of the 10 parts of the areas of life that have been singled out. But Ms. Wimbirsky, how important is it?
Well, it is important. I mean, we've already heard that certainly having your basic needs met and sort of basic comforts and necessities in life is absolutely important to happiness. You're not going to be happy if you don't have those. Now, after your basic needs are met, having more does make people happier. It just doesn't make them as happy as they think they will. So we think that, oh, we'll be just totally ecstatic all the time if we have a mansion and three cars and, vacations. And we will be happier than if we don't have those things. We just won't be happy all the time because people do tend to adapt. Now, I have a new book where I talk about the importance of sort of spending money in ways that make you happier. So having lots of money can be a great thing. It can make you happy. It sort of depends on how you spend it. If you spend it on philanthropy, if you spend it on, traveling around the world or growing as a person, learning something new or teaching others or giving to others, that will definitely make you happier. So what's important is not having things, but sort of what you do with them.
Professor Sonia Lubomirsky at the University of California at Riverside. John DeGraff, let me go back to you, co-founder of the Happiness Initiative based in Seattle. We heard a moment ago from John Helliwell that in Singapore, the prison system adopted some reforms which cut recidivism by a third. That's an extraordinary number. We have more prisoners in the United States than they do anyplace else. Is this something that might be applied here in order to get, I assume this is part of it, prisoners and guards to get along better together?
Well, I think so. I've read John Helliwell's paper on this, and it's great. It's a terrific story, and he would know certainly more about that than I would, but I'd like to see us look at that because we've sure got a lot of prisoners. I mean, we're really ranked number one, certainly among rich countries, when it comes to the percentage of the population we incarcerate, some 7 to 10 times as many people per capita as the Europeans or the Japanese incarcerate. So it's a big issue. One thing I'd like to say, though, is I think there are many ways that this can become part of public policy. And I think of some of the policies in these northern European countries that, as John Helliwell points out, are the happiest. And they include things like much more options to give people work-life balance. In countries like the Netherlands, people really have a lot of choice about their working hours. They have health care, so they don't have to worry about that when their hours are cut back. They have a choice of the hours that they work. Part-time workers receive the same pay per hour as full-time workers for the same kind of work. Benefits are prorated when they shorten their hours, but this gives them more opportunities to spend time with their children, to spend time with community and do things like that. The Dutch law called the Hours Adjustment Act of 2000 is a really important step forward in that direction, and there are many others, and I talk about those in my book.
John Helliwell, we have to ask the question we haven't asked yet, and that is, what about the United States? Where does it stand on the happiness index scale?
Number 11 in the Gallup ladder ranking out of 150.
So that's pretty high.
It's pretty high. It's pretty high. Like everybody else, people look to people who are above them and below them and set their objectives. But it is true that it's a and for good reason.
If that's the case, Sonia Lubomirsky, you're a psychologist. Would people then in the United States be less likely to want to make change and consequently less likely to be concerned about these issues of sustainability on a finite planet?
Yeah, I think that there's some truth to that. Absolutely. I mean, I think people who have sort of the luxury of having, the comforts in life that we all need, they tend to focus on sort of their own individual happiness, sort of, am I going to be happy today and tomorrow, rather than sort of looking at the whole planet. So, yeah, I think I would agree with that.
So it takes something, then, to get people to be more other-directed.
That's right. But, you know, I should note that I actually just have some very, very fresh data from my own lab that shows that people who engage in, you know, so-called green behaviors, sort of who recycle or who worry about, you know, using energy or not driving as much, tend to be happier. So now that's just a correlation, but maybe we could argue that in sort of engaging in green behaviors will make you happier.
Lisa Napoli, a final question to you where we started in Bhutan. It's sort of sad to hear that television has acquainted with Bhutanese all the things that they don't have. And you have to wonder, I guess their Buddhist philosophy didn't extend then or wasn't able to protect them from the idea that they could lead simpler and happier lives than the ones they see depicted on the tube.
Yeah, it does make everybody unhappy and to hear that. But at the same time, I think what you find is that as people get older, they go back to their roots, their religious roots, and the spirituality in Bhutan will guide many people. But yes, it's a complex subject, and just having this kind of conversation is really the point, that it elicits this sort of dialogue. It can only be a positive thing for everyone, Bhutan and beyond.
It's been a fascinating dialogue. Lisa Napoli, once again, author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Learned on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. John Helliwell at the University of British Columbia, co-author of the World Happiness Report, presented at the United Nations Conference last Monday. John DeGraff, co-founder of the Happiness Initiative, based in Seattle. He's author of What's the Economy for Anyway? Why It's Time to Stop Chasing Growth and Start Pursuing Happiness. And Sonia Lobomirsky, again, a psychologist, professor at the University of California, Riverside. Her book, The How of Happiness, A Scientific Approach to Getting the Life You Want. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Anna Scott, Sonia Geis, and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. Visit the Which Way LA blog for even more stories about Los Angeles at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Warren Alneep. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.